Hi, this is the very first episode of the Fictoplasm podcast. One thing we forgot to mention was there will be spoilers because we're talking about books. Hope that's okay. Anyway, here we go.
This is the Fictoplasm podcast, where we'll talk about gameable fiction, the books we like, and the games they inspire us to run. This is the very first episode. I'm Ralph, and I'm joined by Becky.
Hi, I'm Becky.
And Liz.
Hello, I'm Liz.
Each episode, we're going to talk about a book and discuss the content. After that, we'll talk about the games we fancy running based on the content. Note that it's not necessarily about Faith 3 reproducing the fictional world. It could be just taking one or two elements and running with those. It can be as narrow, as broad as we like. Anyway, without further ado, Becky, what are we reading this episode?
We are reading Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie. This is the first in the Imperial, I'm going to say Radak trilogy, although I probably got that wrong. I picked this book up when it got nominated for the Hugo Awards. I picked it up really quickly before it won so that I could get it cheaply. It did go on to win the Hugos. And that year it also won the Nebulas and the British Sci-Fi Award and the Arthur C. Clarke Award and the Locus Award. So we're talking about a book with a pretty serious critical pedigree at this point. I discovered Anne Leckie, recently I discovered that she studied creative writing under Octavia Butler, actually, who's also one of my other favourite SF writers. So I'm not surprised at all about how much I ended up loving this book. It's a book which is described in most places as a space opera, and that is true, and it has a lot of the classic elements of a space opera. It has galaxy-spanning empire, lots of intrigue, and a really sort of well-realised, deftly introduced set of cultures and societies, which I'll talk about in more detail later. But I think to really start out by describing this book as a space opera is doing it a bit of a disservice, actually, because the space opera bit is really the least interesting thing in this book. So the main character in the book is called Breck, and Breck is all that remains of an AI consciousness of a ship, which was called the Justice of Torun. So you have this ship which has an AI in it, and the AI operates through these sort of corpse soldier bodies, ancillaries, which is where the name comes from, Ancillary Justice. And it operates through hundreds, if not thousands, of these different bodies at any one time. At some point, and I'm going to put a spoiler warning in here, at some point the AI gets fragmented, and at the start of the novel, the character of Breck is all that remains of it. And as a result, Breck themselves has a lot of fragmented memories from the time that they were this ship, and the consciousness has existed for over 1,000 years, so there are a lot of memories. Now, the novel runs two stories in parallel. We have the current day adventures of Breck, where they're returning to the Empire, looking for justice, really, for the destruction of the ship that they once were. And secondly, we're exploring the older memories of the ship from about sort of 20 years beforehand, when they were assimilating a planet called Shishura into the Empire. I think the reason this book is so critically acclaimed, and the reason I've chosen it for Fictoplasm, is because it does, for me, what I think classic SF does best, which is giving us a lens through which we view our own society and therefore gain new insights about it. And it does that primarily, for me, through the way that it handles gender. In the society that Breck comes from, there isn't a gender. So I'm going to just clarify here. Sex is the physical characteristics that a person has. Gender is the societal constructs around that. So in Breck society, whatever people's sexual and physical characteristics are, there isn't a particular way of behaving or dressing or looking which is associated with that. And this is explored in a really interesting way. So Breck comes from a society which has no gender and then goes out to other places where they do have gender, and it gets very, very confused as to how to address people and how to classify people, because in their world, these classifications don't exist. And so I think that there are two themes really coming out very strongly for me as to why I thought it was an excellent book. Firstly, the idea of this fragmented consciousness, and secondly, this lens through viewing gender in a really different and interesting way. And that's that.
Liz, what really grabbed you about Ancillary Justice and the sequels?
Well, everything that Becky said as a starting point. is also the stuff that I particularly found interesting. But for purposes today, what I'm most interested in is something that Becky only alluded to quite briefly there, which is the way that the book operates on two different timelines at once, which is something that lots of my favourite fiction has in common, but something that it's quite hard to do in a role-playing game, which we'll talk about more in a bit. But in Ancillary Justice, we've got the kind of the big point, which is the destruction of the starship. And that's both the beginning and the end of the two different strands. So we have one strand going towards it and one strand going away from it. And that's what I think is interesting.
So we covered the big ideas. Some of the smaller things that I like in the story are to do with the bits of ephemera, like the tea service, this obsession they have with tea. And the obsession with tea services, and the way that households are elevated in the Imperium, and how close they are to the Emperor. Is an Emperor? I'm not sure if that's correct honorific.
They use Lord.
Lord, of course, Lord of the Radish. There's things like tea services and the quality of tea, and that's all marvellous. But it's the other thing that really strikes me is the sense of scale, because Justice of Torin is thousands of years old, and she as an individual has the memories of someone who is thousands of years old, and that is there is implied. Not only just obviously aging and having seen a lot over that period of time, there's also social change that's implied. For example, at one point they're using ancillaries, and at some point, this is a slight spoiler, they stop using ancillaries, are no longer used in the Imperium, and that is a social change, a decision that's been taken. Some of the tea services that are described are supposedly millennia old as well. And it's little aspects like that, and the aspects of propriety and social standing of each of the families, that I think those small details embellish the larger points as a whole.
I think you've raised something really interesting, Ralph, actually, which is, you do get an amazing sense of rich culture, galaxy-spanning empire that's existed for thousands of years in what is actually a pretty thin book.
It's
very, very thin. It's a very quick read. You know, and compare that to other kind of epic space opera-type novels out there, which are like doorstops. I think that she achieves this amazing sense of this galaxy-spanning empire in relatively few words, actually, which is incredibly skillful, I think.
The other thing that we should notice is the way that the ships are personalities, even though they are AIs, and they conduct themselves through ancillaries, so they have multiple perspectives at once. But one of the most interesting things is they have favourites. So yes, they have, if they have a favourite lieutenant, that lieutenant on the ship will always find their uniform perfectly fitting and perfectly pressed. They'll get their breakfast first.
Because it's the ancillaries doing the work, and the ancillaries are directed by the ship.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, so I thought, I mean, that's cute. It doesn't actually add much to the plot, but it gives a tremendous sense of, it's the idea of a ship as an emotive being as opposed to an emotional being, as opposed to what we classically think of an AI as something that is probing the limits of its environment and learning, but actually learning fairly dispassionately. So I really like that as well.
I think actually as well, Ralph, it adds an important sense of tension to the novel, because you're right, AIs, we normally perceive them as these emotionless, logical beings, which could be quite dull to read in some ways. But when you're reading the Justice of Torin sections of the book, because Justice has favourites, firstly, they have emotions which you can engage with. But secondly, when those favourites come under threat, it's really interesting, because although we know the Justice of Torin gets destroyed, at the point at which those story threads are happening, we don't know that you know, in the internal fiction, we don't know that the justice of Turing can get destroyed. And so the threat, which wouldn't necessarily materialise for an AI with thousands of ancillaries, is sort of targeted in some ways at their favourites. And I very strongly remember the kind of social threats being levelled at their favourites by other parties being very interesting.
Yeah, so you... You could attack other people's houses and attack other people through the people who are connected to them.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually that brings up one of the other interesting things, which is the whole class system.
Yeah.
Which is, again, there's quite a lot of detail in it that's dealt with very economically. And all of the ways that the different families have this intricately realised relationship with each other, with how close they are to the Emperor, and all of that gets played out to some extent on the ship, despite the ship also having its own parallel structures of hierarchy.
Yeah.
The thing about the big bad is spoilering, we haven't mentioned that at all.
Well, I believe that it's revealed fairly early on, so I think we can say it, that the Lord of the Rats is Ananda Minai? Is that Ananda Minai. And she exists in multiple bodies. For her own preservation. So if one body is destroyed, then she has multiple other versions of herself elsewhere.
She's effectively an ancillary herself.
But the crucial thing, she is at war with herself. So you have two different strands of Ananda Mayanai, which are ideologically opposed. You do have a couple of other things which are political precedents for that. There's an alien race called the Presaga, which has a Presaga, I think.
Presca.
Yes. They are clearly a threat to the Imperium, and at the point I'm with the book, they've only just arrived. But they are possessed of some quite threatening technology which gives them advantages, and so there is a natural fear around any kind of conflict with them. And a lot of what the politics of the book have been constructed to avoid conflict. Let's start to talk about games we'd like to run. And I think, Liz, you're up first.
Cool. So I started thinking about wanting to run a game in which uses the multiple timelines approach. Because, as I say, it's a thing I like in some of my favourite fiction, but it's hard to do in games. And I very quickly wrote myself into a game that actually I'm now really desperate to run, so thank you for asking me to think about that, Ralph, because that's quite cool. So, keeping with the space opera theme, the game I want to run using this revolves around a group of young lieutenants who are they're on their first assignment out of the Space Academy, for whatever form that takes, and they've just been assigned to this ship. And those are the characters we have. The first scene, however, is going to be a GM-narrated scene of a massive explosion, the ship being catastrophically destroyed, and one shuttle containing our heroes running away at speed. So we have this scene-setting thing happening to show the players what the cataclysm is right at the very beginning. And then we flash back to, I don't know, 2 years previous, where they were just starting out on this ship. And then we alternate one scene from before the cataclysm or one scene from after. So the interesting thing to do here is to try and work out how to keep the suspense so that it's only at a conveniently dramatic point that we start to understand precisely what has happened and how we can use what's going on in each of the timelines to build on the other. And I think the kind of technique that you could use to do that is drawn from the kind of indie GM-less story gamey kind of games, where you have quite short scenes focused around a particular question. So, for example, the first scene with the first scene before the explosion could be focused around the question of, how did you first meet? Tell us about the captain's briefing. So you can have the GM or facilitator, more like, really, giving the captain's briefing, telling the crew what the ship's mission is. And then we have this group of lieutenants going off and chatting amongst themselves. They're meeting, they're talking about the mission. And then we flash forward to the same people, now in a much more established relationship, running away. And we're building on what we've just had from that first glimpse, but at the same time jumping forward to what feels like a more mature relationship and trying to build in some more mature aspect of plot. So we could start with a question like, what did you find in the shuttle's control room? Which could then lead back to be a clue to what happened. So we're shuffling backwards and forwards between these two timelines, gradually building a picture of what happened to the ship. Did the lieutenants blow it up for some reason? Were they framed? Was somebody trying to get them and they escaped by accident? And what happens afterwards? Did they get away with it? Did they get caught? We don't know, but gradually by going backwards and forwards, we'll work it out. So that's the idea that I've got that's come out of this book. And I'm desperate to run it now, so...
Sorry, can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Because you know that I love time messing in games myself. And I'm just curious, if you're going to start with a GM-narrated scene or a facilitator-narrated scene which describes a thing happening, how do you make sure that the scenes which build up to it do, in fact, make that thing happen? Because I think we all know when the players get their hands on something, it can go off in a million in different directions. But would you be, as the game designer, would you be setting specific questions they have to ask to drive them to that point, or would you do something else?
That is the big question, isn't it? I think it depends a bit on who the group are, and for some groups of players I would build in some very carefully structured questions and some carefully structured, it would be much more GM'd, GM interventions of other kinds of objects and people they will find around the ship that will build towards what I have more or less planned and kind of quite railroady. With other groups of players, I think it would take a reasonably careful discussion beforehand, but the kinds people who are used to playing this kind of collaborative story gamey kind of approach where you're committed from the beginning to reaching a particular point, I think would need much less structure because they've already seen that explosion. So what they're doing all along is working as a group towards the explosion rather than the perhaps more traditional approach of exploring the character and seeing what their character feels about the various things that are going on. But we've all played games where this kind of thing works, and I'm thinking particularly of your game, Becky, Lovecraft-esque, and my game, Rise and Fall, both of which are working towards a particular point, and everybody knows the kind of point that it's working to at the beginning. And everyone works together collaboratively to reach that moment of ultimate cosmic horror, or that moment where the society catastrophically dies.
Yeah.
I guess you could have some sort of... you could mechanise it somehow by having some sort of conditions that would result in the ship exploding.
Yeah.
You could then see the outcome of each scene would either move you towards those conditions or away from them.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, maybe something more like Hill Folk with some kind of point economy, or I've only played Fiasco once, so I don't know if that would be the right thing. But you could mechanise it that way. Whether that's necessary, I think you'd debate, because I think these are perfectly functional without just as freeform games without anything, just a series of questions.
Yep. Well, I'm also thinking a bit of the rotating dials in the Battlestar Galactica board game.
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
You just made me think of the morale goes up, food goes down, and now we have to prod morale to improve it, or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. I love that.
Becky, your idea for a game?
It will a surprise none of them for you to find out that I'm really interested in exploring the gender aspect of this. And so I've gone away and I've looked at a couple of other games that do interesting things with gender to kind of get me inspired. And first I looked at Dream Askew, which most people are probably familiar with. It's by Avery McDowdno. You can get a free copy of it. I will put a link up in the show notes. And whilst this doesn't exactly focus on gender, it starts us down the path of thinking about genders other than male and female. Because when you create your Dream Askew character, you get the option to choose your gender. And the list of genders for each character, I think, is like about 8 or 7 or 8 different options, which would include things like Fierce or Raven, and then you can interpret that how you wish. But the system itself doesn't really drill down into an exploration of gender. It's just in the way the game is set up and then played out. So then I looked at Nordic LARP, and there are two fantastically interesting Nordic LARPs that mess around with gender, which I'm really going to apologise to my Nordic friends for how I'm going to butcher the names of them, but there's Livskald and Mellon Himmel och Hav. And in both of these games, they create completely new genders, which then people get assigned to. And what I've taken from this is I'm really interested in running a game which explores invented genders to try and divorce us as much as possible from the natural unconscious gender baggage that we all have every day, so that we can take that step back and explore it in the way that the book does. And what I've taken from this is that what I think is really, really key to the success of the Nordic LARPs in exploring gender is they had workshops with the players where they created the culture and the genders and the cultural trappings and expectations of those genders. They were created by the entire gaming group of 70 odd people, I believe, in one case. And so everybody felt they had ownership over those, and they were able to internalise them really easily to then play them out. And so I would be looking to run a science fiction game, because one of the best ways of kind of starting to write a society and a culture from scratch is to just set it in a completely new way on a completely new planet with completely new geography and completely new challenges for the community, so that you can look at gender in a different way, and the position of the gender in the kind of the geographical location, which I think could be very important. So set it on another world in completely different climate, geography, everything like that, and then get your player group of four or five people to sit down together, and in a way which is similar perhaps to Microscope or Archipelago, to create together the framework of the game that you're going to then, the society, the culture that you're going to then run the game in. And then I would have a GM or a facilitator character whose job it is to design threats and challenges and opportunities which are designed to really pick away at the gender that has been constructed by the players.
Okay.
And I'll put some links up to those Nordic LARPs as well, so people can look at them in more detail. But
I think we'll have stuff in the show notes, right? We've mentioned a few games already, as well as Anne Leckie's book. So fantastic, Liz. You got any comments on what Becky made?
You said at the end about exploring scenarios to kind of push the understanding of genders. Do you have any examples of those?
No, I don't. I think that you would want to tailor scenarios to the kind of the gender expressions which the players have created. So I know in, I think it's in Livskald, the idea that, so in our culture, we see creativity, assertiveness as really positive traits. In Livskald, they created a society where they gendered these traits, but they also said that the traits of cowardice and passivity were the dominant and positive traits in this society.
Cool.
And then they would put in threats. You know, you could put in a threat of another society that's really aggressive coming and trying to take over your society or take your land or something like that. And so to really push on the idea that passivity is positive, by saying, well, what happens if you take it to an extreme? What does that mean for your community? So that's the sort of thing I'd be thinking of. And not making any kind of judgment on whether passivity is positive or not, but just seeing what happens when you push on it.
Yeah.
What is the outcome of that?
Right, well, I'll give my contribution then. So for this, I'm going to go all the way back to the 90s. Right, so what I wanted to focus on was the multiple versions of the same person shtick. So that is something that applies to both the single ship with in command of ancillaries and to Ananda Myana. Essentially, this game is a fairly traditional GM and players game with multiple versions of the same character, each played by a different player. And it started as an idea for a one-shot that I went back to recently. And I should also say it's got nothing to do with space opera. This is actually a Mage the Ascension game. So,
retro.
Yeah, retro. It's not even the new World of Darkness. It's the old World of Darkness. Gothic punk. Right. Anyway, so this is a game where the characters' backstories matter a lot. So it's not really going to work with any kind of emergent game like Apocalypse World or its ilk, which is always going forward. So pretty traditional, as I've said, there's a certain amount of setup in terms of character timelines. Each character would therefore have a backstory. Let's say there's five characters. They all start out the same, but at some point in their lives, there's a series of decisions or events with binary outcomes, and there's some uncertainty there, a bit like Minority Report. This results in the split of the timeline. Some characters go down one timeline, some go down another. And then there are further subdivisions as you get down the tree until each timeline is unique. Now, let's say these divisions all happen at preordained times in the character's life, like the maxima and minima of a sine wave. So they all broadly encounter the same events, but at later point they're going to come from very different perspectives, depending on what they did in the earlier parts of their lives. So each event is likely to be around a key theme, like their relationship with someone, being tutored in magic, a climactic fight, or something like that. Now, to make it an actual game, I need to give those mechanical weight and significance. So I'll probably modify the paradox rules somehow. It's already a paradox that several versions of one character are in the same space. And who gets the paradox dumped on them? How do they burn it off? Those are sort of hard rules that need to be defined up front. Also, how do events in the past affect events in the future? If you're saying that a character's life is a sine wave, then maybe there are recurring patterns, and the characters have gathered together right at the point that a whole load of resonant themes are peaking in their timeline. What they do could end up favouring one outcome over another, and as a result, marginalise some versions of the character over others. And you can imagine the different timelines struggling for dominance. Right at the start, you could have your first branching point, which could split the party into two ideological camps. But this is a game, not a novel, so I've no idea how the players are going to react. Maybe they'll collaborate, maybe they'll form unexpected alliances, or maybe they'll sacrifice themselves nobly.
Or each other.
Or sacrifice each other, exactly. So I do actually have a plot, but I'm not going to say any more of that, just in case anyone who's listening is going to play, but that's pretty much it. That's what I've got to say.
Would play.
Cool.
Me too.
Well, it will probably be coming to a con near you. So, jolly good.
Yeah, that also reminds me a lot of The Margarets by Sherry S. Tepper.
Yes.
Oh, I love that book. But we probably shouldn't say any more about it, because I'd like to talk about it another time.
So would I.
All right, well, we've pretty much run out of time. So, thanks for listening. Thanks to Liz and Becky for being part of the discussion and bringing their ideas. And if anyone's listening and wants to get in touch or has ideas or comments about the book we've just discussed, games or fiction in general, we shall have some advice in the show notes. Otherwise, it's goodbye from Becky.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Liz.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Rowan. Not saying anything. And goodbye from me. Cheers. Bye-bye. Thank you.